Do either council have any questions before we begin? Then Ms. Schumacher, you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Bergen Schumacher and I'm with law firm of Bruner Frank. I represent the appellant Calvin Ham for purposes of appeal. I think it's important to note that I was not trial counsel in these two matters that were pending before the district court. There are two issues before the court for consideration today. The first is whether Mr. Ham received ineffective assistance of counsel at the trial court level, and the second is whether Mr. Ham was incorrectly sentenced on the DUI case. So I think it's important to start with a brief overview of how we got here. This is a consolidated matter where there were two district court cases pending against Mr. Ham. The first is CR 21-119, and that case was disposed in a jury trial that concluded on March 22nd of 2022. The jury found my client guilty of possession of a controlled substance, methamphetamine, as well as a DUI. The jury found my client not guilty of refusal to submit to a chemical breath test or blood test, and the DUS was dismissed in mid-trial.
Is it fair to say that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim ties to that first case?
I believe it ties to both cases.
But the actions from the attorney they're being complained of occurred in the first case?
They did occur in the first case. So with this, my client was convicted of those two counts in that first case, 119. After that case had, after the judgments were reached by the jury in that case, then he entered into a plea and sentencing stipulation that dealt with both case 119 and 240. And 240 was pending jury trial. That was scheduled to start approximately 1 month after his convictions in the first case. But for his conviction in 119, it's our position that he likely would not have entered into the plea and sentencing stipulation that he did.
And part of that plea agreement was a waiver of the right to appeal.
That's correct. And so that's another issue that's before the court. The state's position is obviously that he waived his right to appeal the matter of ineffective assistance of counsel. So in determining whether our appeal is properly before this court, we have to look at three different prongs that my client has to satisfy. First is whether or not this appeal falls within the scope of the waiver. Second is whether my client knowingly and voluntarily entered into the plea and sentencing stipulation. And third is whether or not enforcing this waiver would result in a miscarriage of justice. We believe that all three of those prongs are satisfied, and so the appeal is properly before the court.
With regard to the first prong, wasn't the waiver of appeal all appellate issues that are allowed?
Yes. So the exact language is, the defendant waives his right to appeal all issues to the extent a waiver is permissible in 21-119 and 21-240.
And how's that one satisfied?
So obviously that language is very broad, but in drafting that stipulation, it's clear that both attorneys recognized that you can't waive your appeal of absolutely every issue. And so the Sixth Amendment and the 14th Amendment both guarantee your right to counsel and your right to a fair trial. Obviously, Mr. Ham exercised his right to counsel, and he exercised his right to a trial in 119. And so it's our position that he did not and could not waive his right to effective assistance of counsel. So then it would fall within the scope.
What do our cases say about waiving an appeal based on ineffective counsel?
So I believe that, and I don't know how to pronounce this name, but if we look at State versus Iromania, I believe that that case gives us the conclusion that Mr. Ham could not waive his right to a fair trial.
Were there issues of plain error in Iromania? Is that how the court took it up?
I don't know the answer to that question.
How do you respond to the the appellant's colloquy responses to the court that with regard to voluntariness of his entry of plea?
So there is case law. I think if we look at State v. Dye, that case leads us to conclude that the defendant cannot knowingly and voluntarily enter into a waiver of his right to appeal if he has ineffective assistance of counsel. So obviously our position is that
any ineffective assistance of counsel or just ineffective assistance of counsel as it relates to the plea waiver?
Well, I think in that specific case, it was as it related to that particular negotiation of the stipulation. But I think in this case, we have both, because we have ineffective assistance of counsel in 119, which I will get to. But I also think that it's safe to conclude that when trial counsel negotiated this agreement and counseled Mr. Hamm on whether or not he should accept this agreement, it's likely that he didn't go into that meeting and say, here's all the things that I did poorly, and as a result, you did not have adequate...
To follow up on Justice Papik's thought, I think it's the breadth of a waiver and what's permitted, and does it include all a panoply of constitutional rights, and how do we know?
So I don't believe that there are clear cases in Nebraska yet. I'm hopeful that this will be the case that will give us that language that specifically says that you cannot waive your right to effective assistance of counsel. But I think it's implied by the case law that is out there. And so I believe that he did not knowingly and voluntarily waive his right to appeal because of the ineffective assistance of counsel, both in the jury trial as well as in the negotiation of the plea and sentencing stipulation.
Is that alleged anywhere? I mean, is there an assignment of error or an allegation that counsel is ineffective with respect to the negotiation of the plea waiver?
So we did allege an assign of error that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. I believe it's on page 11 of my brief where it says that that negotiating this plea and sentencing stipulation could not have been done upon effective assistance of counsel, given the history of what had happened in 119. So the third prong of that three-prong test is whether or not enforcing the waiver would result in a miscarriage of justice. Some federal circuits have included claims that ineffective assistance of counsel falls within that miscarriage of justice prong. So therefore, I believe that all three prongs are satisfied and the issue is properly before this court for consideration. So now we get to whether or not counsel was actually ineffective at the trial court level. And I know that the court is well aware of the standard in this particular test, must satisfy two prongs, both that performance was deficient and deficient performance actually prejudiced my client's defense. I think that it is quite apparent from the record that the performance was deficient. Trial counsel had my client testify right out of the gate that he did smoke meth on the particular day that the complaint alleged that he did, and that he did that knowingly and intentionally, and he did that in Buffalo County, Nebraska. So essentially, when my client got on the stand, he proved the state's case for them. I don't think that an attorney that was trained in the ordinary skill of criminal law would have satisfied all those elements for the state themselves. I believe in reviewing trial counsel's opening and closing statements that his theory was that Mr. Hamm could not be found guilty because he didn't know that the particular meth that the state was alleging was knowingly and intentionally in his possession, which was the methamphetamine that was in the car. My client didn't know that was there. But all in all, as the state pointed out in their closing argument, it didn't matter because Mr. Hamm had knowingly and intentionally possessed methamphetamine on that morning. Obviously, it also prejudiced my client. Our position is that but for the conviction in 21-119, he would not have entered into the plea and sentencing stipulation that he did. And what leads me to believe that is that the language in the plea and sentencing stipulation specifically outlined the conviction in that case. So
Could the state have proven its case without Mr. Hamm's testimony?
I don't think we know that. I think they might have struggled on that knowingly and intentionally.
Do we need an evidentiary hearing to determine whether that's the case?
So I think that the record is clear enough that this court can decide the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. However, obviously, if the court disagrees, then we would prefer that it be remanded for further post-conviction proceedings.
What ultimately do you want to happen?
I think what would be appropriate in this matter is that the judgments of conviction be reversed, that the sentences be vacated, and that both CR 21-119 and CR 21-240 be remanded for new trials.
Would the habitual criminals return to their pre-existing status?
Obviously, we would prefer that that not happen, but I think that that's what's appropriate in this matter.
Before you sit down, I see you're out of time, but I do have one question. If we were to agree with the state, hypothetically, with regard to the sentencing issue that they raise,
yes,
and would that need to be remanded?
Yes, so we do concede the issue that the state has appealed, that the license revocation was incorrect. So I believe it needs to be remanded for a further enhancement hearing.
And at this point, has the state waived its ability to enhance that to a second offense?
I don't believe that the state has waived their ability under Nebraska case law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiss, good morning to you.
May I please report, Jason Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. As far as Ham's ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we maintain that it's not properly before this court, because Ham waived his right to appeal in both of these cases. There are three components of a valid appeal waiver, as this court explained in State v. Dye, and we submit that all three of those components are satisfied in this case. I'm not going to rehash the three components or analysis on each one, but we do maintain that all three components are satisfied here. So we maintain that Ham's appeal waiver is valid and that his ineffective assistance of counsel claim is not properly before this court. As far as the appellant's assertion that his appeal waiver does not encompass or cover ineffective assistance of counsel claims, we disagree. Dye itself explains that an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is generally exempt from waiver only if it's a claim having to do with the waiver or the plea agreement as a whole and its negotiation. Here, as in Dye, Ham does not allege or argue that his appellate waiver was a result of or a product of ineffective assistance of counsel. He alleges only that trial counsel was ineffective in CR 21-119 with respect to not advising him to not testify. This has no bearing on his appellate waiver or the circumstances of that waiver. So we would submit that the appellate waiver is valid and the ineffective claim is waived.
If that claim is, in fact, validly waived, what does this court do?
If the claim is waived.
What is the result? What would we do if that claim was actually waived? How do we handle the case going forward?
Well, State v. Dye tells us that the remedy in the event of a waiver being upheld is for the case to be dismissed. But given the potential issue of plain error here, I think it depends what you do with the sentencing issue. Because the appeal can't be dismissed in its entirety if you're going to address the potential plain error here. You agree with us. But
if dismissal is appropriate, then how would we reach the plain error issue?
Well, it's our position that you would reject that, you would dismiss their claim and refuse to address it since it falls within the scope of the appeal waiver and is therefore not properly before this court. So you dismiss the ineffective assistance of counsel claim without getting to the merits. And then, at your discretion, if you agree with us, you would address the plain error with respect to the sentence imposed. And State v. Dye contemplates that as well, and specifically notes that in the event that there is a problem, some invalidity with the sentence, that that's not subject to a waiver anyway. So I think what we've pointed out here and what we're arguing is consistent with Dye.
So it would be dismissal of the claim, not dismissal of the appeal.
Correct. If there weren't a sentencing issue, I think the appeal itself could be dismissed, as I read Dye. But with that sentencing error there, assuming you agree, I think that's how it should come out.
It wouldn't be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. It would simply be affirmed because there could be no error based upon the waiver.
Right. It would be an enforcement of the appeal waiver. in a dismissal on that basis, not a lack of jurisdiction, correct? If there are no questions, further questions on the appeal waiver, I'll briefly address the potential plain error with the sentencing order in CR 21-119. If this court reaches that issue, we maintain that the district court sentencing order in that case does appear to contain plain error, given that it reflects that Ham was sentenced to DUI, sentenced for DUI second offense, which is not accurate. The offense was charged as a second offense, but it was never actually enhanced, as there was no basis for him to be enhanced on a second offense. The appropriate remedy in our view, as set forth in our brief, would be to vacate the sentence imposed on that DUI second and reverse and remand the matter back to the district court for further proceedings and clarification on the status of that offense.
I beg your pardon, on the record that exists?
Yes, and I'm not sure if maybe you're alluding to what Justice Frydenberg was asking about.
Yes.
You know, did the state perhaps abandon this or waive it, given that you know, it wasn't pursued. I think this is similar to Valdez on the record before us, because the record doesn't establish that the state, it doesn't affirmatively establish that the state intended to not pursue this enhancement. If that were the case, then I think you could conclude that the state abandoned or waived its right to pursue that enhancement and simply modify the order in question and say this is a first offense and nothing more, and then the sentence imposed is correct as a first offense, a sentence for a first offense DUI. But the record doesn't clearly reflect that, and Valdez explains what we need in order to conclude that the state did in fact abandon or waive its right to pursue that enhancement, and I don't think we have a record that gets us there. As a matter of candor to the court, I spoke with the prosecutor in this case, and it's my understanding that they did not intend to pursue this, and it's my assumption, I don't want to speak for the prosecutor, but it's my assumption that if and when this goes back, they aren't going to pursue the enhancement. I'm not handling this as the prosecuting attorney, but that's my understanding of what will happen, is that they weren't intending to pursue this. But again, I think for purposes of where you're at and how you resolve it, as I read Valdez, the record needs to clearly reflect that the state intended to not to pursue that enhancement, and I don't think our record does, not based on my review of the record, at least. If there's something there that I missed that shows the state did affirmatively intend to not pursue that enhancement, I think you could simply modify the district court's order and say this was a first offense, not a second, and affirm in its entirety.
You believe this court, in terms of our authority, could do that on this record?
If the record reflected that the state affirmatively intended not to pursue the enhancement, I think you could. But in my review of the record, that's not clear from the record.
Does that have something to do with the plea agreement?
The state agreeing not to pursue the enhancement? I think. I mean, it's not in the plea agreement. That's another thing I reviewed to see if is there something there that I could simply just tell you this as a matter of the record and we can be done with this. But there's nothing there, and it's not in the plea agreement. From my communications, that's my impression. But I'm honestly not entirely clear on that.
So does the issue simply arise because the district court judge says I'm sentencing you for a DUI second, but actually imposes a sentence that would not be allowed by a DUI second?
Well, if it were a second, I think the only thing that would be required here that was not imposed is we would need an 18-month revocation as opposed to a 6. But the sentence imposed would be valid for a first. I'm not entirely sure what the district court thought, which is part of why I pointed this out as plain error, because I don't know what the district court thought. Its sentencing order says it's sentencing on a second offense. I would assume the district court was aware that it was never actually enhanced, but I don't know. The record doesn't reflect that one way or the other, which is I think, the difficulty of where we're at, as I was relaying to Justice Miller-Lerman. So in light of the record or lack of record on the issue, it's our belief that the appropriate remedy here would be to remand back to the district court for further proceedings and clarification on that. If there are no...
Going back to the plea waiver, what do we look at to determine whether the waiver was knowing and voluntary?
Well, I mean, similar to a plea, I think, you know, you're just going to look at the circumstances. You can look at the colloquy, including the colloquy in this case, because this specifically was discussed. You know, the district court addressed this matter while the attorneys went through the contents of the plea agreement, and then the court followed up on it and had its colloquy with the defendant and said, okay, I understand there's an agreement in place, you're familiar with the contents, you understand what it says, you wish to proceed, similar to a plea, and he said yes.
What's your response to opposing counsel's argument that counsel would have been unlikely to say, you're waiving your right to appeal claims of my ineffectiveness? Does that matter? Is that relevant?
That counsel would have been unlikely to say that? Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I guess an attorney might be somewhat careful about that because you might feel like that's improper to tell someone you're waiving that. But I guess the record doesn't reflect that one way or the other. I'm not really sure. I can't really speculate as to what counsel would have said, but what we do know from the plain language of this agreement is that it says that they were waiving all claims to the extent permissible, and as I understand the law, that would include ineffective assistance.
So your position is the agreement itself and the colloquy gives us what we need to find this was a knowing and voluntary waiver of anything that could be waived?
Correct. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you...
I do have one quick question. Sure. And I have not looked at the record in this case. Did the colloquy address the issue of performance of counsel, trial counsel, defendant's trial counsel?
I don't recall. I assume you're asking about a question to the effect of, you've had sufficient time to communicate with your counsel and you're satisfied with his or her performance. I don't recall that specific question. The written agreement in question does specifically and expressly say that, you know, the defendant has had time to consult with counsel about this matter. And I don't know about the question of are you satisfied with counsel's performance that we often hear in the plea colloquy, but the agreement does have that in it about communicating with counsel about this agreement.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court, and if you agree that we do have plain error here, we believe that the appropriate remedy would be on that offense to reverse and remand for further proceedings on the DUI second offense. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, counsel. You are excused then. And the state will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Williams.